Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This evening being the new moon night and also the day before Lungta Mahabua's funeral in Thailand. So, actually, it's already, three forty-five in the morning there in Thailand, I think. And so the day is probably already underway at Wat Ban That, where the funeral is due to happen this day. So in honor of Venerable Ajahn Mahabua's life and teachings, and in expression of gratitude to his fine example and exemplary teachings over many, many years, I thought to offer some reflections on what I know, what little I know of his life and teachings this evening, and to bring those up for reflection and for our encouragement. I also feel very unqualified in some ways, and also very humble in a sense, talking about the life of someone who is so highly accomplished and very influential in the best possible way. And so I can only offer what I say in terms of subjective impressions, stories I've heard, or recounting his teachings. I often feel similar in talking about the teachings and life of Lompo Cha. You feel very, very small in relationship to these great beings, these embodiments of tremendous wisdom and kindness, great compassion. Maybe just to start off with one initial anecdote about Lungta Mahabua. He passed away on the 30th of January, aged 98, and over the years, he's had many different ailments and illnesses, and a number of years back, he had a serious heart condition, I believe. And but he gave everybody a bit of concern for some time, that people were worried that he was not going to last much longer, but he recovered and then carried on teaching and leading his community and being a major presence in Thailand for quite a number of years after. So during that time, one day, one of the many, many visitors to Wat Pa Ban That, his monastery in northeast Thailand, in Udon province, said, "Oh, Lungta, please, make every effort to stay around for the benefit of all of us. You know, it's really important that you're here in the world teaching, and that it's really important that you should make the resolution to stay alive as long as you can in order to be a benefit to all of us who have admiration for you and love to hear your teachings." And in his customarily gruff and straightforward manner, he said, "What the hell do you think I've been doing?" The Udon dialect equivalent of that. that was his very direct and blunt approach, is that implying that he could have easily popped off quite a number of years ago, but through his own resolution and out of the direct compassion for people, he had managed to overcome that sickness, to not allow that sickness to bring about the end of his life, and to sustain his presence in the world for some time longer. He was with Ajahn Mun, who also was Ajahn Chah's teacher, for about the last 5 years of Ajahn Mun's life. So as I recall the stories, he came to the monastery where Venerable Ajahn Mun was living, and up to that time, I think it's true to say that Ajahn Mun had not stayed for two successive rains retreats in the same monastery, you know, for almost the entirety of his monastic life, that he wandered from place to place. But in the last 5 years of his life, when he was about 75 to when he was 80, he was persuaded to settle. And so that in this monastery, forest monastery in Sokhonnakhon province, Wat Nong Pur, he stayed there for the last 5 years of his life. And that's where Ajahn Mahabua arrived and joined him and was with him there for that final 5 years of his life. So at that time, Ajahn Mahabua had been a scholar monk. The word Maha in his name means that he'd qualified up to a particular grade of Pali studies and had been a more academic monk. But he had, like Ajahn Chah in some ways, had seen the limitations of being a village monk or study monk and had wanted to dedicate himself more to meditation practice. And he'd heard of Lumpur Mun's reputation as a great meditation master and an enlightened being. And so he'd sought him out in this little monastery in Sokhonnakhon and gone to join him there. So Ajahn Mahabua was still quite young at that time, and there was already many other much more senior disciples who had been around Venerable Ajahn Mun for quite some years. So Ajahn Mahabua was a sort of young, zealous character who arrived at the sort of the tail end of Venerable Ajahn Mun's teaching career. But obviously it was a very close and devoted connection, relationship that the Venerable Ajahn Mahabua developed for his teacher. And if you have read any of his writings or any of his transcribed Dhamma talks, you know, over and over again, he expresses this intense and very heartfelt devotion and admiration for Lumpur Mun and his teachings. And this torch, this, you know, bright, blazing torch of devotion and commitment to Ajahn Mun's way of practice and his teachings is shines very, very brightly and strongly all the way through Ajahn Mahabua's teachings throughout his whole teaching career. That's the sort of guiding spirit, the great, clear, bright guiding light is that of Venerable Ajahn Mun. So he was there for the last 5 years of Ajahn Mun's teaching career, and then during that time he was extremely zealous and energetic, and also obviously quite a gifted student in some ways. He threw himself into the development of meditation with great vigor and commitment, and made great efforts, and was able to achieve quite significant results with his meditation in a reasonably short period of time. Now, Ajahn Mahabua's, again, if you've ever read any of his teachings, or those of you who are Thai who maybe have listened to recordings of his Dhamma talks, or you see his writings as well, he wrote the biography of Venerable Ajahn Mun, and also a collection of a sort of summary. A very extensive summary of forest monastic teachings called Patipatthā, meaning the way of practice. And in pretty much all of those teachings, what comes across is this very pugnacious, kind of blunt, straightforward, almost aggressive, well, definitely, actually aggressive manner in the way that he speaks, and that it's a very sort of full-on and sort of direct way of talking and acting. And that was his character, his personality was of that nature. And One of the incidents that he describes and is has often been recounted is a, in many ways it's an iconic story of his own practice and his own relationship with his teacher, but also indicating very significant aspects of spiritual training, where he had the general style of practice was that you would stay with the teacher for a few weeks or some time and listen to teachings, and then you would go off by yourself to away from the main monastery and practice alone in a more remote place for a number of months or a year or two, and then come back and check in with the teacher to see how your practice was proceeding and if the teacher had any more advice to give you. So that was the general style of training and teaching, that you weren't necessarily living with the teacher the whole time. So during that period, that five-year period, he had received a number of instructions from Ajahn Mun and then had gone off to practice by himself. And during that solitary practice time, he'd managed to develop some extremely profound states of meditation, what are called the formless jhanas, the arupa jhana. So these very, very blissful, bright, formless states of meditation, in which one can sit for many hours or days at a stretch, with the mind absorbed in very, very deep and blissful states of concentration, deep samadhi. And so Ajahn Mahabhu was quite at that time was quite pleased with the results, and so that then going back to visit Ajahn Mun, and then predictably enough, the Ajahn says, "Oh, so welcome back, Mahabhu. How have things been going? What was your solitary time like? What sort of results have you received from your meditation?" And so then Ajahn Mahabhu described these kind of deep states of concentration that he'd managed to realize, and that he found extremely blissful, and was very pleased with the effectiveness of the Ajahn's teachings and how well things were going, and took this as a sign of great progress. And so he was very grateful and appreciative of the teachings. And so he was expressing his gratitude to the teacher, as well as describing the particular qualities of concentration and different experiences that he'd been having. So the way that he's recounted it a number of times was that he was to some degree expecting the teacher to say, "Oh, well done, Bua, nice job. You're only a new guy, and within a couple of years you've already managed to develop your mind, you've developed your jitta to this extent, and to purify your mind of the hindrances to a great degree. Well done, nice work, lad." That's the implication, is that when he was putting it to his teacher, that was what he was going to be receiving in return. But to his surprise and dismay, Venerable Ajahn Mun's response was, "Well, that's not going to be particularly useful to you, so it'd be much better, rather than steering the mind towards those extremely deep states of samadhi, to sustain just the attention, sustain the concentration at the point of access to jhana, rather than going into absorption, because that's the most fertile area for insight. So just back off on that whole deep absorption thing, and just to sustain the attention at access concentration, that'll be much more useful for you." And so Ajahn Mahabhu famously took issue with this and insisted that the Ajahn was wrong, and that he didn't quite understand how useful and how wonderful these states were, and that he was sure this was actually extremely beneficial. And in the accounts of it, they went somewhat head to head, and that this is a young monk taking issue with the highly venerated and enlightened teacher was something that was not not normal in any respect. But also it showed Ajahn Mahabhu's kind of punchy, pugnacious character, and his fearless forthrightness. And so they went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and eventually it seems that the young Ajahn Mahabhu respectfully sort of took his leave and went off to practice by himself shortly after that time again, and then in his efforts to try and re-enter those deep states of concentration, he couldn't get back to them. My suspicion is that the voice of Ajahn Mun saying, "Yeah, don't bother. You don't really need to do this. This is kind of a waste of time." The voice of the Ajahn lingering in the background that kept casting a pall, casting a shadow over the efforts, or in a way just not being able, because he had such respect and love, admiration for his teacher, and something in him just couldn't ignore or couldn't shut out the advice that the teacher had given. So the effect was that he couldn't reabsorb his mind into those deep states of arupa jhana, and no matter how hard he tried, and by his own account of it, he tried and tried and tried and tried and really gave it everything, but he couldn't regain those states. And so the resultant feeling of frustration and irritation, anger, was enormous. And as he said, and it's a statement that I find extremely significant and powerful in terms of how a wholesome state can give rise, when a wholesome state is grasped unwisely, that it can give rise to that which is extremely unwholesome. Because he said, if it had been anybody else other than Tanajan Mun, who'd been responsible for making those states inaccessible to me, I would have killed them. But to me, that's a really powerful expression. Like that, here you have these extraordinarily wholesome and skillful states, the mind purified of the defilements and the hindrances to a very high degree, to be able to establish those levels of concentration, those levels of focus and brightness of mind, and yet because of the way they were picked up and held, that gave cause for homicidal urges towards his own beloved teacher. That it was anybody else that had taken those things away from me, I would have killed them. That's a powerful statement. Now maybe he was exaggerating it somewhat, but he's expressing that sense of rage and frustration that came from those beautiful states being no longer accessible to him. So then, as the story goes, he went back to Ajahn Mun and bowed and asked for forgiveness and recognized that the teacher was right and that he needed more training and more guidance, and that he was far too arrogant and self-righteous. And so then, by following the teachings that Ajahn Mun had given him, he did in fact aim at developing more insight, but also later on he was able to re-enter those deeper states once again. But it was when that was more useful and in a context, a greater context of wisdom and understanding than he had picked them up and developed them before. So that incident, it represents in many ways that sense of a very characteristic quality that is there in Ajahn Mahabua, and that he carried that through, that same kind of aggressive style, aggressive manner through much and much of his life. I mean, some of the photographs that we have, like particularly the one in the sala up on the shrine, he's very bright-eyed and smiling. And I don't think there are that many smiling pictures of him before he turned about 80. Only in the last 15 or maybe 20 years of his life that he actually smiled for the camera once in a while, and that he dropped the persona somewhat of being the aggressive and ferocious taskmaster. The one incident that comes to mind in that respect was back in the early 70s, George Sharp, who was the chairman of the English Sangha Trust, which is the group that ended up inviting Lumpur Sumedho and this community to be established in England. Prior to that time, in the early 70s, before George had met Lumpur Sumedho, they had a close connection with Ajahn Mahabhu, the English Sangha Trust had a close connection with Ajahn Mahabhu and his monastery, because one of the original group of people ordained as bhikkhus in the 1950s, Venerable Panyuwado, Ajahn Panyuwado, who had been ordained in 1957 in Wat Phak Nam in Thailand. He had been a student of Venerable Kapaluwada. Kapaluwada was ordained in 1956, originally just ordained by himself. And the next year, four more men from England went out to Thailand and were ordained at Wat Phak Nam. I think they were Panyuwado, Vijayawado, Saddawado, and another Wado. It was four of them, anyway. So of that group, very, very quickly, even Kapaluwada faded out and disrobed within a short while, and the others, Saddawado and Vijayawado, also had bailed out. And after a couple of years, Venerable Panyuwada was the only one left. So for about a five-year period, he was left in charge of the Hampstead Vihara, and he was the monk there. So from about, I think, 57 to 62, he was looking after the Hampstead Vihara on Haverstock Hill, and was very much a part of the central element of the English Sangha Trust's efforts to establish a monastery, a Buddhist monastery here in Britain. But after he completed his 5 years, so the first 5 years as a bhikkhu and living in the sort of apprentice role, as one does for the first 5 years. After that five-year period was finished, then he took his leave of the English Sangha Trust and the Hampstead Vihara and went off to Thailand to Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, and I suspect with a vow never to return. It was extremely hard work and very, very testing for him to be a brand new monk alone in London in the Vihara. No other people were ordained during that time, and so he had to look after the whole thing by himself, and it was very burdensome and challenging in many ways. So he took off for the forest and joined Venerable Ajahn Mahabhu, who was at that time and subsequently the most famous and highly regarded forest monk, most well known within the Bangkok circles. And so that Venerable Panyuwado went out to Ajahn Mahabhu and joined him from 62 or and perhaps 63. So there have been various ups and downs with the Hampstead Vihara. A bhikkhu called Ananda Bodhi had come and gone, and then Sangharakshita had come and gone. And in the early 70s, then George Sharp thought, well, maybe we can see if I can go to Thailand and persuade Venerable Panyuwado to come back to the Vihara, and maybe I'll have a chance to see if the Venerable Ajahn Mahabhu would come to England as well. So in 73, George went out to Thailand, to Wat Phabantat, to Ajahn Mahabhu's monastery, to pay respects to him and to see Venerable Panyuwado and to see if they could make a visit to England, and also if they could persuade the Ajahn to let Venerable Panyuwado settle back in London and be a teacher, and to live as a bhikkhu in England and to help start a community here. So George went out there in 73 and was staying at Wat Phabantat. And when he went there, then he was quite surprised, because there were not that many visitors from overseas. And when he came and he spoke to Ajahn Mahabhu and made the invitation for him to come to the Hampstead Vihara, expressed his gratitude for the examples of the forest monastic teachings and how they would really aspire to have a monastery happening in Britain, and really hope that Thanajan Mahabhu might be able to help out. But in response, Ajahn Mahabhu was quite sort of blunt and dismissive, and was not very helpful or friendly to George at all. And just his whole manner was quite sort of dismissive and uninterested. And so George was a bit puzzled by this and spoke to Venerable Panyavado and said, you know, I'm really astonished, you know, that you know, the Ajahn's like this. You know, I've come all this way. So would it be possible to have a sort of proper interview with him, just you and me and him, to see if you know, I'm understanding, you know, what he's saying, or if he really you know, appreciates you know, what I'd like him to do, or if he appreciates the kind of invitation I want to make. And because, you know, he just, his manner seems to be very off-putting, and I can't really believe that he's as you know, he's being so sort of negative or uninterested as he seems to be. And so Venerable Panyavada said, okay, well, we can talk to him. And again, I'm not sure of all the details. This is how I've heard the stories, but this from George and others. So then they had another conversation with Tanajan Mahabua, and they paid their respects. And so George said to him, George is also a very forthright and direct person, said, Tanajan, I'm very surprised. I've come here all the way from England, made a lot of effort to come out here to visit your monastery, and I think I've conducted myself with respect and behaved appropriately. But you seem to be very rude and and impolite and unfriendly and dismissive. And all I want to do is to hear your teachings and to, you know, possibly invite you to come and teach in England and to see if Tan Panyavado can come back and also be in London again. So could you explain why you're being so rude and unpleasant? And of course, when it was put to him in such a straight way, then he just burst out laughing and thought so. And he was also quite impressed that a person, you know, this foreigner, would speak to him in such a direct manner, because no Thai person would ever say things in such a blunt and straightforward way. You know, that we actually sort of say that sort of thing to his face. And he said, we laughed and laughed and laughed. And George thought, okay, well, obviously I haven't upset him too much. And he said, oh, well, you have to forgive me, because I'm a really coarse person. And, you know, this, if I come across as being, yeah, unfriendly and aggressive and uninterested, you know, you have to forgive that. That's just the surface. That's just the skin of it. And that might be the appearance of things, but I'm not trying to be unfriendly or impolite or unappreciative of your invitation and your generosity and your sincerity in wanting to help establish community in Britain. So please don't be fooled by the way it looks on the outside. And he thought it was hilarious. But not that he'd upset George, or that he, but just that how he didn't intend to put across that message, but how his own personality, his own style, was in a way so sort of coarse and so unrefined, and had this effect on people. So that he was apologetic and said, you know, this is not something that you need to take as the whole story. But, you know, underneath this gruff exterior and the way I express myself, you know, I do appreciate your efforts and your goodwill. So George was very very encouraged by that. But it's also, in that respect, it's a good lesson in terms of the distinction between what's going on in the jitta and what might be happening on the surface, the what's called the personality or the nisaya. Because that was a common experience, or people would often ask, you know, how can an enlightened being come across as being so sort of angry or impatient or aggressive. But the conditioning of the personality type the way that the mind is habituated to particular forms of expression, particular character traits, that is in a way just like the color of your eyes, or the size of your feet, or the tone of your voice. That it's a particular conditioned pattern that's there, and that when someone is enlightened with arahantship, it doesn't mean that the personality disappears by any means, but more the personality is just the means of expression, that which the jitta functions through. So it has its own kind of filtering or colouring effect, but it's not necessarily indicative of the purity of heart. So it was kind of a characteristic of Ajahn Mahabodh that he would see and he would come across and display a great degree of ferocity, being fierce and stern and challenging. And if you look at read his Dhamma talks, there's an extraordinary number of boxing analogies, like you slug the kilesas and knock them down. You beat a avijja into a bloody pulp, so it has to be carried out of the ring on a stretcher. You know, there's no kind of two ways about the way his mind is thinking, that you're in a fight. And that's what he would say. Like, I'm a boxer. You know, that's the way I talk. That's the way I think. I'm an aggressive and coarse fellow. That's the way it comes out. But one has to take that persona, that mask, and look beneath it. And that it's really quite marvelous in a way how so many people could appreciate that. That there really was a genuine, absolute purity of heart. There was I think, almost universal recognition that Ajahn Mahabodh was indeed an arahant, had fully completed the path, and arrived at full enlightenment, full liberation. But that didn't preclude that he could come across as this grumpy aggressive and demanding teacher. I remember hearing one story of some of the monks from Wat Pananachar going up to visit, being taken by the Ajahn from Wat Pananachar, the monastery for Western monks, up to Bantat one time. And so they paid respects to Ajahn Mahabodh, and he's asking for teachings from him. And one of the monks was sort of started to lean on his arm on one side like this. And you think, well, that's, if you've been sitting there for a while, it might seem quite reasonable just to lean to one side. You know, it's kind of normal to, if you're sitting in the polite side posture, and that's a kind of normal thing, sort of relaxed but interested. And just that very gesture of leaning on his arm, I believe, initiated a roasting for I think a good hour or a couple of hours even, that Ajahn Mahabodh just took this as a sign of the degeneration of the religion, and Buddhism was coming to no good, and that just the fact that a monk, a junior monk who's young and vigorous, would be so lazy and sloppy and uninterested in Dhamma, that they would lean on their arm during the time of listening to a Dhamma talk, and really kind of as the phrase he would use himself, in a manner that would shrivel your liver, one of those liver shriveling deliveries that has burned itself into the collective memory of the Wat Pananachar community. Like, if you go to Bantat, do not ever lean on your arm. It's like, that's not to be done, unless you want to be roasted alive. So, so another of the connections that this community has with Venerable Ajahn Mahabodh then is after that. That visit that George made, despite being having that uncomfortable beginning to his visit, and feeling like the Ajahn was thoroughly uninterested and dismissive of his wishes, he actually accepted the invitation. And so in 1974, then Lungtan Mahabua and Ajahn Panyuwado came to England, came to London, to the Hampstead Vihara, and stayed for some time. And there's a little book of Ajahn Mahabua's teachings called the London Talks, I believe, from that 1974 visit. And that people were very inspired and uplifted. That was the only time that Ajahn Mahabua came to Britain. And they even hoped that he would leave Ajahn Panyuwado behind. But as it turned out, then he said, "Yeah, I know that you're interested to have Venerable Panyuwado here, yes, come back to deliver the Vihara again. And yes, he's a very well-trained monk and he's very well established, but he really wants to stay, to continue his practice and training at Wat Ban Thot." And so that also, apparently, they even hoped that they might persuade Ajahn Mahabua to stay in England at one point. That was a real long shot. But he said, "No, I'm going to go back to Thailand, and Tan Panyuwado is also, he wants to come back there with me. But also, but don't worry, because someone else will be coming along. So don't feel too despondent." And again, I'm not sure of the exact wording that he used, but people who were there, like George Sharp and others who were involved in the Vihara at that time, recounted that he made that comment that don't worry, someone else will be along, and that he'll be able to be much more suitable for your efforts. And then, sure enough, 2 years later, that was when Ajahn Sumedho came through in 1976. Ajahn Sumedho came through and stayed for a few nights, 3 nights at the Hampstead Vihara, and the rest, as we know, is history. That they made that contact, and then George invited him to come back and stay in. And then again, George made the trip to Thailand, met Ajahn Chah, and then they came in 1977. And then Ajahn Chah agreed that Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Khemadhammo originally, and then the other two bhikkhus, Ajahn Anando, Ajahn Viradhammo, who were visiting family in the USA, invited them to stay at the Hampstead Vihara as well. So from the following year, 1977, the four of them established the first Sangha of bhikkhus in London, from our community. And so that this whole collection of monasteries, this whole community, was hatched from that point. So we are connected in that close way, in that direct way, with Ajahn Mahabua's his efforts, his teaching, his practice. And so there's a definite, a specific debt of gratitude in that respect, that he was part of what helped keep the flame alive in London with the English Sangha Trust and the Hampstead Vihara, and that helped keep the interest going there, and the encouragement for George Sharp to make that invitation. So we are grateful in that respect. And also just for the example that he has given, and the many teachings he's given, and the presence of his own wisdom, his readiness to teach, and the many hundreds of people, thousands and thousands of people who have benefited from his teachings, and particularly other great Ajahns, the monastic disciples of his, both nuns and monks, who have, on the basis of his guidance and his example, have also developed huge degrees of wisdom and qualities of liberation. There's many, many teachings that he's given over the years. Probably the most famous of his teachings is an essay that he wrote back in the 60s, which is called Wisdom Develops Samadhi, and that's in the, I think, the very first book of his teachings in English, which is called Forest Dhamma, and in there is this essay that he wrote, Wisdom Develops Samadhi. And it's that particular teaching is very much in accord with Ajahn Chah's own style of teachings, that they didn't have a particularly close association, Ajahn Mahabhur, Ajahn Chah, that they had visited each other's monasteries a number of times, but when Lumpo Cha passed away, then that very day, Lungtan Mahabhur came straight down from Udon and met the community of Wat Pa Phong and gave teachings to the Sangha assembled there the day that Lumpo Cha passed away. And then at the funeral of Lumpo Cha a year later, then the main talk on the funeral night was given by Venerable Ajahn Mahabhur. So there was a respectful and friendly connection between them, even though it wasn't sort of particularly close over the years. But this this particular aspect of teaching and the approach towards samadhi was when you read that talk, Wisdom Develops Samadhi, you can see it's very close to Ajahn Chah's approach, because classically speaking, what is said is that samadhi is what you need to develop wisdom, that on the basis of precepts, the sila, then samadhi is developed with sila as the basis, and then with samadhi as the basis, then that gives rise to wisdom. And that's the classical sequence. Sila leads to samadhi, samadhi leads to wisdom. So this was deliberately flipping that around, or saying that there is another aspect to the training, to our practice, where wisdom is a direct cause for the development of samadhi. And the analogy that he gives is the way he talks about it, he said there's two different kinds of people. There's a kind of person for whom concentration comes very easily, that their mind is quite simple and straightforward, and that they're just applying effort based on a purity of heart or based on good sila, then it's quite simple and straightforward to be able to develop concentration. And he likened this to a tree that's standing out in the open with no other trees or obstructions around it. And if you want to cut the tree down, to saw it up to make timber, then it's very easy to do so. It's got a clear space all around it. It's very simple and straightforward. Yeah, other people's minds are much more complicated, and they have many more obstructions, or the mind is very active or busy. And so that he likened this to a tree that's surrounded by other trees, and so in the dense part of the forest, and so its branches mingle with the branches of other trees. It's got vines growing from above and tangled in the branches, connecting it with other trees, and so it doesn't have a clear space all around it. So if you want to fell that tree to use it for timber, then you have to look and see where are the other branches intruding, where does it cross over with other trees, where do the vines come in from, where are they hanging from, and then trimming back the vines, trimming out the branches that are interrupting entangled with the branches of your main tree. And when you are able to clear away the entangling vines, the intruding branches, and they clear the space around that tree, then you're able to fell it and use it for timber. So he said this clearing of the obstructions, if you have a mind like that, this is a mind that is, say, more conducive to being liberated through the development of wisdom. So the first kind is more the sort of mind that is liberated through the development of concentration, the cetta-vimutti type of mind. So the second type is more the panya-vimutti type. And so that in order to develop samadhi, you have to apply wisdom. You have to apply that quality of investigation to look as you're endeavoring to concentrate the mind to see, well, what's it entangled with? What is the mind longing for? What's it thinking about? What is it remembering? What is it planning? What is it calculating? what are the opinions that it's juggling. So this is the equivalent of looking at the entangling foliage around your main tree. Where did the vines come from? Where are the other branches coming in? Where are they crossing? What's in the way of what? Looking and exploring, and then steadily trimming things back and clearing the space. So this is the instance of where you need wisdom to develop samadhi. So that very direct application of investigation of dhamma vijaya, or also you can call it yoniso manasikara, wise reflection, that in the process of developing concentration, that you need that element of exploration, of investigation, to see where the entanglements are coming from, how they work, what's causing them, where do they come from, how to cut them off, what kind of tool you need to trim them back. And so this is very, very much in accord with Ajahn Chah's style of approach towards development of samadhi and the application of mindfulness, using this sense of exploration and seeing where the attachments are forming, and having seen that, seeing where attachments are, recognizing that the mind is tricky and active and busy, and particularly when your mind is conditioned to do a lot of thinking, a lot of remembering and planning and opinionating. This is an extraordinarily helpful approach. And so that is a very helpful and useful teaching, because sometimes it can be seen that, or it's described that, in order to develop concentration, you have to sort of cut out any kind of thinking, or any sort of cut out as much mental activity as you possibly can, and just bring the attention to the desired object and then push everything away. But as Ajahn Chah would often encourage, in this same exposition, Lungta Mahabua describes, no, it's far from the use of conceptual thought being conceptual thought being intrinsically problematic or an intruder or unwanted. The skillful use of reflective thought and the power to investigate, to recognize the patterns of activity of the mind, a few well-placed thoughts, some clear reflection and consideration can conduce very directly and greatly to concentration, to peacefulness of mind, to the aspect of focusing and clarifying the mind, freeing the heart from the hindrances. It's also interesting that Thomas Merton, the Christian, well-known Christian monk, who had many Buddhist sympathies, described that essay of Ajahn Mahabua's, Wisdom Develops Samadhi. He called it a spiritual masterpiece. So it even is very applicable in the from the sort of Christian contemplative point of view. Yeah, he can understand that and relate to that. For myself, the particular teaching of Ajahn Mahabua is that stands out and that I found most helpful is a teaching that comes from his account of his own experience of enlightenment. And also he's kind of unusual in the fact that he quite openly and directly talks about his experience of full liberation, which most, not that there are that many arahants about, but those that are tend to not speak in any detail, or not even necessarily directly acknowledge that they've reached the fulfillment of the path. But Ajahn Mahabua, again in his characteristic straightforward, punchy, no-nonsense sort of a way, said, the end of the path has been reached, and so there's no need to be not deceptive, and no need to be kind of shy about that. The end of the path has been reached, and so if people want to know about that, I'll talk about it. I believe he was fairly reticent for many, many years, but eventually after and quite a few decades of teaching, he began to speak sort of quite openly and directly about that experience. And there's a whole book of his teachings called Arahata Magga Arahata Pala, the path and fruit of arahatship, that he speaks quite directly and forthrightly about that. And so it's also a measure of the high regard in which he's held, that not that many people have criticized him for that, even though it's one of our training rules is not to speak about any level of attainment that there might be in a direct way. He has felt that, well, out of compassion for people and out of, in a way, to help the arising of faith, to acknowledge, yes, well, there is, you know, full enlightenment is possible, and yes, it has been realized. And it doesn't have to be a personal thing or put forth as some sort of self-aggrandizement in any way at all, but more just, yes, this can be talked about to help inspire, to encourage, and to illuminate how that works and what that